Office Hours, a social science podcast produced at the University of Minnesota, featuring conversations with prominent scholars, researchers, and other movers and shakers in the social world.
This episode, we talk with humorist Dylan Brody about the power of humor and storytelling to transform the way people look at the world around them. Brody discusses the effects of television on political comedy, the sad state of heroes in our storytelling today, and how he incorporates his political knowledge and ideals into the personal stories he tells before audiences. Ladies and gentlemen, Office Hours with Dylan Brody. So I think I just mentioned to you, I was listening to your latest CD, Brevity, this morning.
Brevity is not my latest CD.
Oh, what's the latest?
Brevity was my first CD, actually. Oh. The latest is A Twist of the Wit.
Oh, okay. So that must be really recent then, because Brevity was 2009.
Brevity was 2009, as was True Enough.
Oh, okay. So you're very prolific then.
Last Monday, on Valentine's Day, A Twist of the Wit dropped from Stand Up Records.
All right.
Brevity is a studio-recorded CD.
Okay.
And then the other two are live performances.
Oh, okay. But anyway, at least speaking for Brevity, it's fascinating. And you use storytelling to reveal the complexities of issues like religion, homelessness, censorship, police violence, homophobia. I could go on. And, you know, as sociologists, when we were talking about doing this interview, we're jealous because, you know, we tend to grapple with the nuances of subjects like this, but we make them dry and boring. And somehow you, and you're not alone in this, a lot of people use comedy and humor to really, I was told I shouldn't call you a comedian, is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
So a humorist, is that correct?
Humorist is good, storyteller is good. I used to be a comic, I used to be a comedian.
Okay.
Because I am now doing something that is slightly different from what's expected in comedy clubs, my manager tells people not to call me a comedian, and then every interview and every conversation starts with, "So I'm not supposed to call you a comedian."
So what's the difference? What are you doing that comedians aren't supposed to do?
I wear cufflinks. In modern comedy, in large part because of the advent of cable and the comedy boom of the late '80s and early '90s. Comedians are expected to get a laugh every 15 seconds. Mm. They're expected in large part, not entirely, and it's starting to change now with some wonderful comics, Lee Camp and Jamie Kilstein. There are some young guys on the scene who are doing spectacular political work. But comics became more and more generic over the course of the 80s and 90s. Observational comedy was to be purely cultural and not at all political or politically driven. Any point of view that could be seen as in any way threatening, in any way risk-taking, was squelched. Because there was this thing about reaching the widest possible audience and having a tight 6 minutes to get on TV with, and it turned into lots of Jerry Seinfeld imitators. People doing innocuous material about socks in the dryer. And when I shifted from what I was doing as a comic and moved into writing and then into long-form storytelling, I abandoned the idea that I am required to get a certain number of laughs per minute. I allow myself the fullness of storytelling as my way in. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And, you know, it's funny because storytelling and narrative is something that a lot of sociologists have talked about in terms of how to understand and grapple with how people are immersed in a social world and think about the world around them and interact with other people. Stories are very important to how we work and how we come to understand other things. So it sounds like you sort of draw on that in your own work as well.
Oh, I certainly do. I think I had a heartbreaking experience several years ago when I was the artist in residence at the prep school from which I had hitherto neglected to graduate. They brought me back as artist in residence, and I was teaching, among other things, I was teaching an adventure fantasy writing class because I have a couple of books published for the young adult adventure fantasy market. And one of the kids brought in a story where the hero, within the first few seconds of the story, randomly kills a family to get a cart that he wants. And I was troubled by this, and I began to ask the students how we know who the hero is in a story. And these are kids who grew up under Reagan after the 60s and 70s. So all of the peace movement and the idea of nonviolent civil disobedience was sort of steeped out of the culture. And they had been fed this myth that the 60s were, that the peace movement was a group of, you know, drug-addled love mongers. Mm-hmm. And that they had been proven wrong because Carter was vilified. Mm-hmm. However the hell that logic worked. So I was trying to get them to tell me how, you know, who the hero is, and all they could come up with in a movie, who they could figure out who the hero was because he was the guy who was on the screen the most. That was all they could come up with. Because through the 80s and much of the 90s, that was the only distinguishing characteristic. The heroes behaved just as badly as the villains. The hero was established by who had the biggest gun and who got in the final kill. Mm-hmm. And I found that really troubling because for most of history, stories were told to teach us how to be heroes. The whole purpose of storytelling was to improve our ability in the hunt. This is what happened today. The buffalo were running south, and we were running behind them. And then Dave thought, maybe if someone stands in front, and suddenly people had this next step of learning. Even if you get to works of scripture, the Bible, the Quran, the Torah, it's all storytelling toward how do we behave better as people. And as the entertainment industry takes over the world of art, we lose the responsibility for what's being said. I have oft said that entertainment is the word people use when they don't want to take responsibility for what they're saying through their art. And when comedy became part of the entertainment industry and stopped being a forward-thinking, cutting-edge, envelope-pushing art form, it lost what had drawn me to it to begin with. Storytelling, because the form is unexpected, can come in under the radar in the way that comedy used to. People listen to a personal experience, and by putting together my personal experiences in such a way that it draws people into images and language and rhythm and empathy, I'm able to layer in a certain amount of social commentary and political commentary and informative and instructive ideas about how to behave as a hero, how to behave as a human, that I think is worthwhile. God, I hope it's worthwhile. And also, you know, I'm funny.
One of the things I wanted to ask you about is, and I think your comment about heroes and, you know, sort of the dim view that people have of what a hero is kind of plays into this, is each issue of Context, we usually have a theme or two. So this issue, we have two, and they're kind of stark contrasts. On the one hand, poverty is one theme, and the sort of grim reality of poverty and how it's lived. On the other hand, the theme is utopias and utopian thinking and sort of grand ideals about how to change the world and make a better future and things like that. So I'm just curious, you know, it seems like on the one hand, you're doing both things. You know, you want people to be able to have this ideal about how we should live, but you're also trying to sort of paint a portrayal of things that are kind of grim sometimes, right?
Absolutely. You know, we live in the richest country, at least up until recently, the richest country in the history of mankind. and yet we have a lot of poor people. And that seems to me to be inherently wrong. It seems to me that a lot of the proposals that have been put forth, it's easy to blame poor people for the ills of society because they can't defend themselves. But that's basic bullying. Attacking the people who can't defend themselves is what every bully does. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that in a decent society, you recognize that the existence of poverty, one recognizes the existence of poverty is the ill and cannot be blamed on the poor. I don't know if you remember the Reagan-era welfare reform proposal that was based on the idea that the best way to discourage people from being poor is to take away their money. Mm-hmm. But that seemed deeply offensive to me. Under Bush the Second, there was a thing called the marriage incentive, which was based on the idea that the best way to encourage women to feel a sense of fiscal responsibility and independence was through a state-mandated marriage of fiduciary convenience. Again, entirely inappropriate approach to the issue, which is why do we have so many poor people? And the disparity between the poor and the rich has been growing and growing and growing in this country because of unchecked capitalism. It is my theory that the purpose of capitalism is to make a nation wealthy enough so that it can ease itself toward socialism. That in a truly utopian society, the basic needs of humanity are met, and then the people are free to explore their own greatest potential. Now, capitalism is all about competition, and I believe that the greatest potential of humanity is reached through cooperation. So, because capitalism builds a wealth base through competition, sadly, the people who are coming out ahead in that competition tend to think they deserve to be coming out ahead, and therefore everyone else deserves to be left behind. And when capitalism becomes the end rather than the means, you lose the goal of a utopian society, and you wind up in a race to the top that leads the culture as a whole into a spiral toward the bottom. Wow, that sounded like I actually know things, didn't it?
Well, one of the things that I was thinking of is linking sort of serious thinking about topics like this with storytelling and sort of humor. Like you start one of your one of the tracks on Brevity. I don't mean to make this all about this. If it's this CD, if it's your third oldest CD, but it's still one I've listened to. So, but I like it. You start off the Secret Shame of the Casual Conspirator, and you're sort of writing a sort of a lecture or essay on free speech, right? And I think I have the right one. And then your wife reads it and says, "This isn't funny. Don't do this." And then you tell a story that illustrates, I'm guessing, kind of the points you were trying to get across in the lecture.
And I apologize for being so lectury in this interview. If you prefer, I can tell you stories.
That's not what I meant. What I was trying to get at is, listen to and understand and sympathize with your argument that you're making. But then, how do you take something like that and distill it into a story that communicates those points to people, that brings them in the way that you were describing earlier about storytelling?
Well, everything I do is narcissistic. I went to my at one point. I said to my wife, "I seem to be making a career in narcissism," and she said, don't be silly, honey. You tell your stories about yourself, and everybody else thinks about the stories of their lives. Mm-hmm. You speak to the narcissist in all of us. Mm-hmm. And that made me feel a little bit better about myself, and really, what is the goal of what I do if not to feel better about myself, because I'm making a career in narcissism. I start from a story of an experience I've had where I can tell that something interesting happened there. Mm-hmm. And just in telling the story, I start to figure out what the underpinnings are that are fun, mm-hmm. that are meaningful, that are universal. And as long as I'm talking about sort of universal themes, I'm going to touch on stuff that feels culturally and societally important because they're universal. And the more honest I am about who I am and what my experience of the world is, the more I'm going to be touching on universal themes, because ultimately the experience as a human being is the same for all of us. We're all struggling to be better and feeling inadequate and wishing we could do more for those who are in need and wishing we were in a better position ourselves. All of these things are the basic experience of humanity in the world. And they are also the things that make up the cultural experience and the societal norm. So frequently, by focusing on my own truth, I come to the larger societal norm. There's a piece on the second CD on True Enough called Democracy 101. That's all about the nature of the nature of the democracy that we live in, which is not entirely democratic, but pretends to be, to keep everyone feeling fully involved and engaged. Mm-hmm. And I talk about that through an experience of a grade school election that I was part of. But everybody remembers some form of grade school election.
Did you win?
What?
Did you win?
Yes, I did. I was the only one who had a platform. They gave us a day to produce our platforms, the few of us who were running for... We were chosen alphabetically who was going to run for mayor. And because I was third in the alphabet, I got to run for mayor. And I suspect that it was a three-person race because... She wanted me to be in the race because she knew I was the smartest kid in class. And I suspect it was a three rather than four person race because she wanted me to have my best possible chance of winning. And we were supposed to come in with our platform on one day and no one else had anything to say. And I had index cards. I had a plan and I was going to tax and we were going to have ice cream at the end of the year. And I had a whole plan going. I wound up winning and becoming mayor, and then at the end of the year when there was extra money left over from the taxes, the deputy mayor, who was clearly a young Republican, wanted to do a big tax refund to everyone in the room. And I said, no, we'll share with room four. We'll have them over for the ice cream party because we got extra. Damn it, it's the right thing to do. But that wasn't true. The fact was, I wanted to share with room four because there was a girl with one arm in room four who I had a crush on, but had never had the courage to talk to. Mm. But I had the idea for the tax. It was my plan, so we were going to do what I wanted. And so room four came over, and we all had ice cream. Ultimately, the point of the story is that the candidates are selected, they're not elected, and that even a properly elected leader, when his own personal perversities and agenda are challenged, will resort to fascism. And it all comes through in this story, but it's about kids collecting 2 cents a day and voting in class and, you know, all that stuff. And there's this experience that draws people in. It's the story that everybody remembers, and you don't realize until it's pointed out that, oh, this really is how it works. Mm-hmm. It really is a mentalist's trick. We choose, you know, we put the four aces in front of you and let you choose which suit you're going to have run you.
I'm curious about the risks in what you do, because this is a it's pretty risky when you're trying to make a point. And I mean, I'm just wondering. I mean, a couple things. You know, there's sort of the obvious thing about offending people. You know, obviously you've probably offended people before. You know, maybe people didn't expect the politics to come along, since you said the norm in comedy has been to be stripped of politics and stripped of
part
the message.
Part of why I had to stop doing straight-ahead stand-up comedy was that I was a political comic, and it was incredibly frustrating. I am far left on the political spectrum. So I was doing heavy-duty, very funny political comedy. And I had, for example, I had, when I was doing stand-up, depending on how the room was going and how much time I was doing, 7 to 12 minutes of my set was about the way in which homophobia is the last culturally accepted form of bigotry. Mm-hmm. There are other forms that operate, but this is the last one that is culturally accepted. And then I would do all these jokes about it, and I knew in order to get laughs with these, because a lot of comics were doing easy fag jokes, mm-hmm. in order to get laughs with what I was doing, I had to be funnier than they were. So I was. Mm-hmm. And people would come up to me afterwards and go, "That was really funny. Hey, I got a queer joke you can use." And it would break my heart. Because I thought I had been so clear. Mm-hmm. And it was just incredibly troubling to me that people could hear what I was saying and still be living in their world of homophobia and be thinking that I agreed with them because they laughed at what I said.
I think as teachers, a lot of us have had that same experience in the classroom too. Like I'm vividly remembering one experience where we were talking about sort of the history of the Middle East in a very, I would even say, dry, factual, but clear manner. I thought people were understanding it. And afterwards I had a student come up to me and sort of like, and started like, and emailed me afterwards, pointing to all of these very ugly, anti-Semitic, racist websites. Thinking that it was supporting what I had just taught him, you know, like I really enjoyed what you were talking about. It reminded me of this.
People always hear through the filter of themselves. Mm-hmm. There's a thing that I talk about at the beginning of my show a lot. People will come up to me at the beginning of the show. There's this first applause before I've said anything, you know, as I'm welcomed to the stage, there's applause, and it's wonderful, and it's pure, and it's hopeful. And I know what that applause is. And then sometimes by the end of a show, I'm not sure anymore, because I get all this applause at the end, and then people come up to me, and they say, "I love that story you told about," and then describe a story that sounds only vaguely like anything I remember having said. Mm-hmm. And it leads me to this recurring fantasy, the sort of imagining that that Georgia O'Keeffe used to spend a lot of time at art openings saying to people, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, you're saying my flowers look like what?" People are always hearing everything and filtering it through their own lens. I just read all the Harry Dresden books by Jim Butcher. And because I was sort of wrapped up and buzzing through this series of goofy books, I was going to websites, and I was looking at what people say about him and what the response is. And there was this one guy who said, "I love Jim Butcher. It is so clear that, like me, he is anti-Obama and thinks we should have a smaller government, and he's pro-this." And I'm reading it going, I got none of this from the books. This is not in there. This is you, because you like this character, thinking the character agrees with you, and therefore the writer must agree with you, all of which is a load of nonsense. And you can't control, there's no controlling what people hear. It is my hope that with my stories, I'm layering stuff in deeply enough that some of my ideas get through even to people who disagree with me. That, because part of what I do is set up parallels without saying that I'm setting up parallels, and then allow the connections to be made by the listener. And it is my hope that by doing it that way, people come to the same conclusions that I hope they'll reach. But if they don't, you know, either way, I get a check at the end of the night.
Another thing that I wanted to ask you about is people talk about like the Daily Show a lot as being very, you know, it's very popular and it's sort of a funny comedic take on the news and current events. But then, you know, a lot of people wonder what's the end result of that? Does that make people actually get out and get engaged, or does it just sort of produce this kind of cynicism? Like, you know, you laugh at the ridiculousness of the world and then you just sort of forget about it and go on about your day. So I'm curious if this is something you struggle with in your work, not only trying to, you know, communicate these sort of, you know, principles and ideals and lessons to people through what you do, but actually engaging them to get out and do something about it.
No. First of all, I think The Daily Show and Colbert Report do have an effect. I think satire is one of the most powerful tools we have to affect the way people think. Comedy in general, comedy and humor and jokes in general, are very, very powerful. When people laugh at something, they believe that it is true. And they give their implicit stamp of approval to whatever it is they've laughed at. It's why hecklers are so shocking. Because that's somebody who, in a room full of people who are implicitly agreeing with an idea, stand up and say, "I disagree," except, you know, when the comic is bombing and then the heckler thinks they're helping, but that's a whole different thing. And by the way, they're not. If anyone listening to this thinks that they can help a comic by heckling, just stop thinking that. You're mistaken. Now, there's an example I've used before, although not on a CD, and I don't know if it's been recorded, so I'm going to do it here as though I'm just thinking of it off the top of my head. when a person says on stage, "Supermarkets are bizarre," there's a layer of resistance. The audience thinks, "No, they're not. I'm in a supermarket every week." And then the comic comes up with an example of how supermarkets are bizarre. And I don't know what that example would be, and I don't have the jokes written on it. But, you know, a group of people who have never met each other stand around choosing their food in public. That's an odd thing, and there might be a series of jokes on that. And what do you do when the cute woman sees you pulling Gas-X off the shelf? That's, you know, am I going to change my... There's all sorts of stuff you can do about how supermarkets are bizarre. And as soon as you get laughs with it, the audience agrees with you and never sees a supermarket the same way. Now when they walk into a supermarket, it's no longer that fabric of their experience moment that they're used to having. It is, "Oh, wow, yeah, I don't know these people, but we're all making these intimate choices around each other." And there's this slight change in the way they feel about it. David Brenner did a joke when I was a child. I saw him do it on TV about he was sitting on a newspaper in a subway, and someone came up to him and said, "Are you reading that?" And he said yes and stood up and turned the page and sat back down. And since that moment, anytime I see someone sitting on a newspaper, that joke just flashes across my head for a second. It changes the way I perceive that moment. And jokes have that power. It's why racist jokes and anti-Semitic jokes are so powerful and dangerous. Because by drawing on stereotype that is not true, it allows people to make a connection and laugh at a joke that then reinforces the stereotype and causes them to continue to believe it and see the groups of which they are not a part, or even the groups of which they are a part, in the same light in which they have been shown before. It's why I object to anyone who says on stage, "And I can say this because I'm," as in, "I'm black, so I can say this," or "I can say this because I'm a Jew." No, no. It becomes more your responsibility to write the more difficult joke that dispels the myth. Now, how did I get started on this rant? Oh, yes. This is the nature of humor and the nature of jokes, so that something like The Daily Show really can change the way people look at a political idea, really can change the way people think about what the government does, what the people do who are responding to the government, what the media does and the way it approaches things, the way in which we take things from the media. It changes the way people think about all of that all the time, and therefore is genuinely powerful. In terms of my work, I just want people to look at me and clap.
And making them laugh is enough.
When I was a political comic, I really wanted to change the way I thought I could change the world through this. Mm-hmm. And it was over and over again, it was disheartening and sad. And I wound up, you know, weeping alone in stoned hotel rooms, mm-hmm. cursing my fate for what I had gotten into. Mm-hmm. Whereas with the storytelling, I know that whether I am changing people's minds or not, I am taking them with me on a lovely ride into language and rhythm and the music of words and their own imaginations and their own memories. And I enjoy having them look at me, and I enjoy having them clap for me, and I enjoy having them tell me that they enjoyed the evening. So there's all that self-gratification that comes out of it that I love. And if I can change one or two people's thinking in the process of that, that's gravy. Mm-hmm. That's just beautiful. Yeah. There's a one-person show that I book out whenever I can. Feel free to get me booked into the college there anytime you like, called More Arts, Less Marshall. That is, I want to say a dilution, but that's not what I'm over. A concentration of all my martial arts related stories. And I have a great many of them because I'm a martial artist. And it takes people with me from having been a bullied non-athletic kid to being a Taekwondo master. And at the end, I bring the entire audience with me on a guided meditation. And I have the entire room sit in silence and listen to their breath as they hear my voice. And to go from being a comic who needs a laugh every 15 seconds to someone who can stand in the front of the room and have complete silence hang there, for me, is a huge point of satisfaction and personal growth, and it feels good. The audience at the end of the evening inevitably has this feeling of accomplishment, because they've gone from a place where they're expecting someone to entertain them passively to having been given the power to sit in their own space and feel their own strength as a room full of people. So whether they go home knowing that something has changed or not, I know that something has changed. And I can't spend too much time worrying about how much each individual audience, that's the singular, by the way, audience, and all one of them can do is applaud. That's the singular. You can get applaud from one audience. And they should all tip their waitry, which is the plural. I can't worry that much about how much each individual is changed by what I do. All I know is that if I change entire rooms full of people a tiny little bit, then overall I am doing what I can to push the world toward a more peaceful, more confident, more giving, more loving place. And that, you know, that can't be bad.
No, it can't. Not at all. Well, I got to say, this has been very, very good.
Good.
I appreciate your taking the time to talk to us. Any last words? Anything you wanted to get in there before we call this quits?
Yes. The newest CD is called The Twist of the Wit. It's my third CD with Stand Up Records, and I am enormously proud of the work on it. All of my CDs are available at Amazon.com, iTunes, and at DylanBrody.com.
All right.
And I thank you for letting me plug that at the end of the show.
I will put links in the show notes.
Boy, it has been delightful to talk to you, man.
All right, great. It's been wonderful talking to you, too. Now, wasn't that great? Go buy the guy's albums right now. Thanks to my co-hosts here at Office Hours, the TSP team at Minnesota, and the University of Minnesota College of Liberal Arts for their love and affection. That's all.
You're gone. Are you there?
I am there. I am here, yes. Is that good. Is that a dog or something?
Yes, that is. That was Sir Corwin, the beautiful dog-faced dog, Brindlebeast of Somar.
The dog-faced dog, yes.